conventional wisdom tells us that when the world starts to wobble, you know, when inflation spikes or geopolitical instability hits, you buy gold.
Right.
Maybe you buy some land, or you just try to ride out the stock market volatility.
But for the truly wealthy, that ultra high net worth crowd, the playbook is just, it's fundamentally different. When chaos hits, they are not buying what the public buys. They're quietly moving their capital, and they do it really early, into assets that protect wealth way better than the traditional markets.
And these are assets that, metaphorically speaking, you can fit inside a small bag. That whole element of discretion, of portability, it changes everything about how you weather a crisis.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're doing a really intensive exploration of these elite strategies for safe haven asset accumulation. We're going to cut through the noise and unpack the precise mindset of that wealthiest 1%.
Yeah, and our source material gives us a really clear look at how they define a true safe haven asset. Because the stuff that worked 20 years ago, you know, relying on macro stability, it's failing now. Rapidly.
So our mission today is pretty straightforward. First, we're going to establish the three immutable rules, the necessary rules that define a real wealth protector in this modern, highly correlated world.
Then we're going deep into five very specific asset classes they're actually using. We're going to move from, say, fine wine and luxury bags, all the way to industrial metals, high-end collectibles.
And of course, the big one, the highly debated role of Bitcoin in their portfolios.
And we'll connect these things that seem so different to show you exactly how these quiet strategies provide protection, discretion, and often some pretty significant growth, even while global downturns are just chewing up traditional portfolios.
Okay, let's get into it.
So let's start with why that classic safe haven formula, the buy gold, buy land advice, why it's failing, or at least breaking down pretty fast. The issue isn't that gold or land are, you know, bad assets. It's that under modern economic pressure, they just lack the discretion or that non-correlation that the elite are now demanding.
That's such a key distinction. We've seen these synchronous global downturns where all the major economies fall together.
Right.
And we've seen quantitative easing on a scale that just washes through the entire financial system. So the super rich, they pivot long before the public even realizes trouble is coming. We're talking months before a Fed announcement.
Their focus isn't just preservation anymore. It's preservation combined with discrete mobility. When you look at something like commercial real estate, it slows down dramatically. It becomes illiquid, like instantly in a downturn. Stocks swing violently.
So their goal is something portable,
Yeah.
something discreet, and something highly liquid that protects their capital without any hesitation or stress. It's a completely different paradigm. They aren't trying to make a 20% return in a bull market. They're making sure that the money they have stays protected and, crucially, easily movable if capital controls suddenly become a thing, or if the financial system itself starts to seize up.
So if those old rules are broken, what actually defines a true safe haven asset, an SHA?
At its core, it's an investment that stays steady or maybe even appreciates when the rest of the market is just falling apart.
It's the destination for capital that's fleeing acute uncertainty.
Exactly. And our sources show that these assets hold their value because they stick to three immutable pillars. You have to hit all three. And the first pillar, the essential shock absorber, is non-correlation.
Non-correlation. It means the asset just can't dance to the same rhythm as stocks, bonds, or real estate.
Right.
If the S&P 500 drops 30%, a true safe haven asset has to remain flat, or even better, be moving slightly upward.
And think about it this way. For the wealthy, protection isn't just about saving money. It's about having immediate functioning liquidity when their leveraged portfolios take a massive hit. Ah, the margin call.
The margin call. If their stock portfolio triggers one, they need an asset they can sell instantly for cash, an asset that hasn't also collapsed. That independent movement is just critical for true portfolio stability. It helps them avoid a catastrophic liquidation.
That distinction, the ability to act as a counterweight against a margin call, is why non-correlation is just paramount. If everything falls together, you haven't preserved a thing.
The second pillar is limited scarcity. And this has become exceptionally important, particularly since 2008 and the, you know, the eras of massive central bank intervention and rapid currency devaluation that followed.
If an asset can be printed or inflated or mass-produced, and that could be fiat currency or even, you know, mass-produced art prints, the elite just won't trust it with their core wealth.
Not at all.
You need hard limits on supply. They're essential to hold value when currencies devalue or when the whole financial system is just flooded with money that's looking for a home. If that supply cap isn't absolute, or it's not naturally constrained by geology or time, it just doesn't offer real protection against the dilution of currency. It's the ultimate hedge against quantitative easing.
And finally, the third pillar, which our sources call intrinsic value.
Yeah, this one's key.
This just means the worth has to exist outside of any promise made by a government, a company, or some major financial institution.
The value has to be rooted in something tangible. The material itself, the craftsmanship, the history, or just undeniable cultural demand.
Right.
Because when promises fail, and they often do during a severe crisis, you need something whose worth is just inherent in the object itself. Its stability doesn't rely on the trust you're placing in some external institution.
So why is intrinsic value more critical now than, say, in previous cycles?
It's because promises fail during a crisis. The value has to be inherent in the object itself, and that now includes the promise of liquidity across borders.
Okay, so let's move on to the actual assets that the super rich are accumulating right now. The first category really embodies this idea of discretion and scarcity, what our sources call liquid gold.
Ah, yes, fine wine and rare spirits.
Exactly.
What's so fascinating here is the scarcity mechanism. It's unique. Unlike buying gold bars, which just sit in a vault, this market shrinks automatically. Why? Because consumption permanently reduces the supply.
Every time a bottle of rare Bordeaux or some aged single malt is opened and enjoyed, one less bottle exists in the entire global investment market.
It's a natural process of depletion. It ensures that scarcity just increases automatically over time, and that creates a built-in appreciation engine that very few other assets can match.
Yeah, the older the vintage, the rarer it inherently becomes.
And the performance data really reflects this shrinking supply. The Knight Frank Luxury Investment Index, which tracks these returns, showed that fine wine delivered 146% growth in the decade leading up to early 2024.
That's steady, reliable appreciation.
It is. But rare whiskey. It soared even higher. It hit a staggering 280% increase in that same period. That performance, I mean, it truly outperforms most traditional stock indices over the last 10 years. It makes it a really powerful non-correlated protector.
And the anecdotes here really illustrate the potential for that value explosion.
For sure. Take the 1945 Romane Conti bottle. That vineyard's production is tiny to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
That bottle, which once cost a negligible amount of money, sold by 2018 for $558,000.
That is the definition of value protection combined with powerful natural appreciation.
So where's the opportunity now? Well, our sources suggest that sophisticated investors are quietly moving into this market. The LIVX 100 index, which tracks wine prices, saw about a 9 to 11% market correction in 2024.
And that temporary drop is seen as a golden opportunity for those with long-term capital.
Especially for premium Burgundy wines and high-quality single malt whiskeys. Historically, once these high-end bottles get consumed, and consumption never stops, scarcity becomes irreversible, and the market rebounds sharply. Usually within a year or two.
So it's a cyclical buying pattern tied directly to the inevitable depletion of supply. And the wealthy know exactly when to enter that cycle after correction.
Okay, next up, let's look at what the sources call armrest assets.
Armrest assets.
Luxury bags and high-end watches. The name itself just emphasizes that portability, that discretion, and liquidity. Everything we talked about in the first segment.
These assets are just remarkable examples of how the wealthy store highly concentrated value. An exclusive timepiece or a rare handbag can hold the value equivalent to an entire suburban apartment.
But they offer this unmatched instant liquidity.
They really function as an instant international currency.
They do. You can travel across the world with them and trade them in any major city, Tokyo, Paris, New York, often with far less scrutiny or regulatory oversight than if you were trying to move a large amount of gold or cash across a border.
It's truly portable wealth storage.
And when you analyze the performance of certain luxury handbags, specifically that Hermes trio, the Birkin, the Kelly, and the Constance, the data suggests they behave more like high-yield government bonds.
But with dramatically lower volatility than either gold or the overall stock market, they're shock-resistant.
Over the last 5 years, these particular bags delivered an average annual growth rate of 21%.
21%. That figure is just staggering, especially when you consider that same period included major global shocks like the pandemic and high inflation, when so many traditional markets struggled.
And this value protection comes down entirely to scarcity control. Hermes maintains these famously tight, intentional supply constraints. It's not like you can just walk into a store and buy one off the shelf.
Oh, not at all. This is where the mechanism gets fascinating. Customers have to meticulously build a large purchase history.
The Hermes journey, as they call it.
Right. You often have to spend $2 or $3 on other ancillary Hermes products, scarves, shoes, belts, just to earn the possibility of being offered a desired bag that costs $1.
It's a manufactured arbitrage opportunity.
The Birkin Himalaya is the perfect, almost unbelievable example of this. It retails for around $60,000 to $80,000, depending on the specifics.
But on the resale market, the real market, it has never sold for below $200,000.
So the price you see in the store is essentially just an artificial discount to the bag's real market value,
which is governed purely by the desperation of demand and the impossibility of supply. Hermes intentionally leaves money on the table in the primary market just to reinforce its scarcity and brand mystique.
High-end watches operate in a similar way. Brands like Rolex, Patek Philippe, Audemars Piguet, they act like a highly specialized, low-risk stock market.
And the value is backed by brands with centuries of history, impeccable reputation, and unparalleled craftsmanship.
Let's use the Patek Philippe Nautilus 5711A as a case study. When Patek announced they would discontinue the model in 2021, its retail value of $35,000 immediately exploded.
Exploded to nearly $150,000 on the secondary market. Just like that.
The mere act of discontinuing a model solidified its absolute scarcity and protected its value floor permanently.
And even after the 2024 corrections we've seen in the broader watch market, that Nautilus still trades steadily at a robust $80,000 to $100,000. The market instantly priced in the fact that it was non-replicable.
But does the extreme artificial scarcity of assets like Birkin bags make them inherently unstable if the brand decided to change its policy? I still kind of wrestle with how these non-traditional luxury assets outperform. It just feels like a trust game, you know.
Their value rests on maintaining absolute intentional supply control. If Hermes ever flooded the market, the entire ecosystem would just collapse. So they won't. Okay, now we're going to shift gears completely. From luxury craftsmanship to tangible utility, we're talking about industrial metals.
Right. Our sources suggest that platinum, silver, and copper are becoming these new generation safe haven assets.
And it's because they are absolutely essential for the future economy, and they're facing unavoidable long-term shortages. This speaks directly to Pillar 3, utility.
Platinum is a fascinating case study in perceived value versus utility. It's often called the most undervalued major asset.
Because it historically traded significantly above gold.
Exactly. Yet today, gold is priced several times higher than platinum.
And investors are betting that this massive pricing gap is expected to close, and close dramatically. Why? Because the market is entering a severe supply deficit. It's projected to be between 500,000 to over 1 million ounces per year between 2024 and 2028.
That's a huge structural imbalance.
And the root cause isn't speculative. It's geopolitical and infrastructural. South Africa provides about 75% of the global supply of platinum. Mm. And they are locked in an ongoing structural energy crisis. The constant rolling blackouts managed by their state utility, Eskom, you just can't extract the metal if you can't reliably power the deep mines.
It creates this hard, real-world limitation on supply that's driving long-term scarcity, regardless of what global economic demand cycles are doing.
It's an involuntary, absolute scarcity.
Then you have copper. Goldman Sachs famously called it the new oil.
And for good reason. Copper is truly indispensable for global electrification, for grid modernization, the push toward decarbonization. We literally cannot build the green infrastructure of the future without it.
The demand drivers are just immense and unavoidable. For example, the average electric vehicle requires 83 kilograms of copper,
which is almost four times more than the copper you need for a traditional gasoline car.
So that means demand for copper is being pushed higher regardless of overall economic cycles or short-term downturns.
Mm-hmm.
It has inherent value linked to future necessity. It ticks that intrinsic utility box perfectly.
And for investors, accessing these industrial metals can be done strategically. You can buy physical metal ETFs, or you can take equity positions in major, well-run mining companies.
Which neatly avoids all the logistical, storage, and security challenges of, you know, storing raw physical metals yourself.
You get the intrinsic value without the headache.
So let's move to the ultimate definition of scarcity, the one-of-one assets, collectibles, specifically art, ceramics, stamps, and rare coins.
These are the objects that simply cannot be recreated. Their scarcity is absolute.
And the ultra-wealthy use these assets strategically to convert large amounts of volatile cash into stable, tangible pieces.
Unlike gold, where more can theoretically be mined, a specific masterpiece or a royal Chinese ceramic cup is fundamentally finite. There will never be another one.
The stability of the art market really reflects this protection.
Mm-hmm.
It's delivered an average return of 14% annually over the past 25 years.
Which compares very favorably to the S&P 500's 9.5% return over the same period and often with lower volatility.
What's also critical for its safe haven status is the stability you get from the ownership structure.
Right.
Rare artworks rarely decline significantly in value because their owners are typically billionaires who are under absolutely no financial pressure to sell during a downturn.
So that lack of forced selling maintains a consistently high price floor.
And here's where the massive appreciation linked to history and scarcity comes in. Whoa. Imagine the returns here. Leonardo da Vinci's Salvator Mundi bought for about $1.17 million in 2005.
Yeah.
Sold just 12 years later, in 2017, for $450 million.
That's approximately a 64% compounded annual growth rate. It's just mind-boggling. That is the power of absolute historic scarcity merging with cultural demand. It's not about the paint. It's the story and the impossibility of replication.
And this extends to antiquities, particularly royal Chinese ceramics, which are highly beloved by Asian elites precisely for their prominent scarcity.
These pieces allow the rich to store tens of millions of dollars in an object small enough to fit in one hand. Extreme value density.
To put a number on that, a tiny Ming Dynasty cup sold for $36 million in 2014.
It just proves how powerful this safe haven asset can be for portability and value storage. Ticks the discretion and the briefcase boxes at the same time.
And speaking of portability, stamps and rare coins offer perhaps the highest value density of any asset class. They often surpass even diamonds in a compact space.
And the top 250 investment stamp index has seen consistent growth of 10 to 11% annually over the last decade.
Their biggest advantage, which loops right back to our opening premise, is discretion.
A portfolio worth hundreds of millions can be carried across borders in a simple album. And that doesn't trigger the scrutiny, the tracking, or the regulatory oversight that huge quantities of cash or physical gold would during an economic crisis or a capital control lockdown.
So given these massive, sometimes astronomical returns on rare art and collectibles, why do these assets only appeal to a small, niche group of elite investors?
Because they require specialized knowledge and immense capital. Plus, they lack the instant market liquidity of an ETF. You can't just sell $50 million of ceramics tomorrow morning.
All right, our final safe haven asset is probably the most contentious and definitely the most modern, Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
And our sources make it really clear that the ultra-rich do not treat Bitcoin as a traditional shelter in the same way they treat gold. It's more of a modern defensive tool that just behaves differently from everything else.
This requires a really nuanced view. You have to separate the short-term reality from the long-term thesis because they operate on completely different timelines.
Okay.
In the short term, Bitcoin is still just too volatile to act like traditional gold during sudden geopolitical shocks or immediate market collapses.
It reacts sharply to risk aversion. When investors panic, they often sell their highly appreciated or volatile assets first, and Bitcoin tends to swing much more dramatically than the S&P 500 during those acute downturns.
Right. And that volatility means it just hasn't fully earned the title of safe haven in those acute crisis moments. If you need absolute stability today during a severe market crash, Bitcoin historically has not provided that consistently.
So it violates the non-correlation pillar in the short term.
It does. But the mindset of the super rich isn't focused on the next 6 months. It's focused on the 5 to 10 year horizon. And over that extended period, they don't see Bitcoin as just a shelter. They see it as a growth asset with strong inflation hedging power.
It's a long-term bet on the future of a decentralized digital financial system.
Exactly. It fulfills the absolute scarcity pillar, that 21 million supply cap, perfectly. And its intrinsic value is tied to network security, global decentralized utility, and immutability, rather than it being a physical object.
And the growth potential is backed by some incredible historical performance. That program scarcity, the halving cycle, historically pushes Bitcoin up dramatically.
Yeah, post-halving returns have ranged from 300% to 1,200%. The systemic programming is a huge driver of long-term value.
And we're seeing massive, unmistakable institutional validation now.
We are. The new wave of institutional ETFs, the spot Bitcoin ETFs, they've already absorbed $15 to $20 billion in net inflows within just months of their launch. This suggests the establishment is incorporating Bitcoin into serious large-scale wealth preservation strategies.
These strategies are looking ahead. The future projections are aggressive. Major established institutions like Fidelity and Standard Chartered are projecting Bitcoin reaching $200,000 to $500,000 in this cycle or the next.
And long-term models even suggest Bitcoin competing for gold's current $13 trillion market cap. That potential competition alone makes it a strategic asset for inflation hedging and digital wealth storage, even if it remains volatile.
So when you analyze portfolio strategy, studies show that allocating just 1 to 5% of total assets to Bitcoin can significantly improve long-term portfolio performance without adding disproportionate risk.
Yeah. Right, provided it's viewed as a long-term hold.
It's not meant to replace gold. It's more of a strategic slice.
This allocation is seen as a powerful complement to gold during those extended fiat currency devaluation cycles and, crucially, as a strategic call option on the future of global money.
So if Bitcoin is still too volatile for short-term crises, how can the rich justify holding it as a safe haven at all?
It protects against future currency devaluation. It fulfills the scarcity pillar long-term. It's a hedge against government instability, not market instability.
We've covered a tremendous amount of ground today, moving from, you know, vintage wine cellars and the artistry of Hermes to the structural deficits of industrial metals and the volatility of digital ledgers.
But the crucial shift in the elite safe haven strategy is absolutely clear. They are moving away from relying on the stability of the macroeconomy stocks, bonds, broad real estate, and moving toward assets defined by absolute scarcity and intrinsic transportable value.
To reiterate, they are hunting for assets that have those three immutable characteristics. First, non-correlation, acting as that necessary shock absorber against a market-wide collapse.
Then limited scarcity, meaning it cannot be printed, it can't be inflated or replicated by a competitor.
And finally, intrinsic value. Its worth is independent of any government or financial promise, and it's rooted instead in material utility, craftsmanship, or cultural history.
The five classes we covered, wine, luxury bags, industrial metals, high-end collectibles, and Bitcoin, each protect wealth by fulfilling these criteria in different ways. They provide both discretion and powerful growth potential.
Yeah, whether it's the discretion of a rare stamp collection or the utility of copper, they are the new definition of protective wealth.
We spent all this time detailing assets worth millions, but the underlying lesson is pretty simple. True safety isn't found in what's easy to buy or what everyone else is selling. It's found in assets that carry inherent, undeniable value that transcends national borders or the fleeting promises of financial systems.
If scarcity is the true key to modern wealth preservation, how many of your current assets meet that non-correlated, non-replicable test? That's the question we want to leave you with today.
Thank you for joining us for this deep dive.
We'll see you next time.